She'd always come in and spot the shoes as if it were for the first time, and start in on Jack. Didn't he know where to put his shoes? Didn't he know the piano was not the place for them? This joke, and Mother's clockwork response, continued while Jack was president. Bobby was attorney general, and I was a senator. Even Jack's presidency didn't buy him much slack around the Cape House. Not many weeks after his inauguration, he was a bit fatigued as he joined the rest of us for our usual weekend at Hyannisport. He slept in late on Sunday morning in his old first-floor bedroom, until he heard the footsteps of our father ascending the stairs after the 11 o'clock Mass at St. Francis Xavier Church. Realizing that he was just seconds from being caught and scolded for missing Mass, the President of the United States threw himself out of bed, yanked on a pair of pants, sneaked out of the door, hightailed it toward the garage, and scrambled over our neighbor Roger Curry's fence to safety. Just a few final random memories now of life in that sanctuary in those sweet summers before the war. In the evening, before dinner, we'd gather in the living room, where my mother would play the piano. She played with great delicacy and finesse. She'd come downstairs at 6:30 and seat herself at the keyboard, and she'd play until the family had formed. Then she'd stop, and the conversation would begin. Once in a while, Jack would drift into the room from vigorous games out of doors after changing into a clean shirt, an absolute requirement in my parents' home. When a lull softened the general din, he might nod to Mother, and then begin to sing, alone, to her accompaniment. My brother had a fine voice, a fact that very few people know. One of his favorite tunes was September Song. Jack would imitate the gravelly voice of Walter Houston, who'd made it famous on Broadway, and still project the ballad's aching tenderness. And the days dwindled down to a precious few. September, November. Sometimes Jack would sing that song directly to me. At dinner, we would often sit down to platters heaped with clams and lobsters. We were not assigned seats, but Mother and Dad always sat in the same places. We each had a napkin, and that napkin was expected to last the entire week. If it suffered any stains, which of course is what napkins are designed to do, too bad. One a week. I had two or three important roles in our summer dinners. It was my special task to head down to the shore with two buckets and return with enough salt water to cook the shellfish. Another chore was to bring home fresh water from the pump at the golf course. Two of Dad's mealtime passions were good tomatoes and fresh water. Finally, if our dessert was ice cream, it would be ice cream that I had churned by turning a handle for about 45 minutes over a bucket of ice. I was one of the few fellows who could claim that ice cream made me physically fit. Our noisy dinner table always bore the foods of the seasons. When the corn was in, we had corn on the cob. And then we had corn pudding. And then we had cornbread. Every meal seemed made of corn. And when the blueberries came in, everything was blueberry. Blueberry pie and blueberry shortcake and blueberry muffins. The same with the strawberries. And of course, the cranberries. But whatever dishes were set before us, the one menu item that never varied was conversation. After grace, ideas and information would start to flow. The spirit was generally upbeat, but always informative. Only rarely did the talk grow heated, and even then it had its comic side. I recall one mealtime when Joe Jr., who had recently traveled in Russia, began to wax enthusiastic over what he'd seen there. Joe was reliably his father's son when it came to economics and politics, but he'd been more than a little naive in his reaction to the way the Soviets described their system. "You know, there's something interesting about that communism over there," he declared to our father. "This idea of each according to their need, each according to their ability." That was as far as he got. Dad set his knife and fork down. "When you sell your car and sell your boat and sell your horse, you can talk to me about that." he exploded at Joe. "But otherwise, I don't want to hear any more about it in this house." And boom! Up he got, and out the door he went. The kicker was that as my poor brother sat there open-mouthed, my mother said to him, "Joe, you shouldn't upset your father." After dinner, toward sunset, my father liked to retire to his porch on the second floor and sit in the corner by the window that looks out into the harbor and the lantern that was there. He would read into the late evening, but he'd also keep a lookout for his younger children as we trudged home from one last sail or game of tennis or flashlight tag. If you were it, and if you shone a flashlight on a hiding child, they were out. Jack continued playing flashlight tag with the younger children as president. A variation of flashlight tag, which we also played into adulthood, was a game we called murder. We'd play with all the kids and adults and use the whole house at the Cape. Someone was it, and if they tagged you, you were dead, but then you became the murderer. The goal was to hide from the murderer so that you were the last person not tagged. One night, Congressman Jack Kennedy was the second-to-last person tagged, and he couldn't find the last person, who had crawled in Mother's hatbox shelf. That person was Lem Billings, Jack's loyal lifelong friend whom he'd met at Choate. Since they couldn't find him, Jack proposed that everyone go to a movie. When we all came back 2 hours later, we found Lem still in that closet, covered with sweat and still waiting to be caught. As children, we'd have to be home from our games by the time the streetlights came on. And of course, as the summer days got shorter, the lights came on earlier and earlier. If any of us arrived late, we'd pick up the gaze of Dad's steely blue eyes at about 30 yards, and then whatever excuses we'd invented would melt by the time we got to the door. Dad could see everything that was happening from that chair in that room. Everything in the world, it sometimes seemed. Down in the basement was a small movie theater with projector and screen that Dad had installed. Through his Hollywood connections, he could get new movies before they were released to the theaters. We saw the Walt Disney feature cartoons like Dumbo and Snow White. Dad knew Walt Disney, who gave him several of his paintings, renderings of his cartoon characters. For a long time, we had those paintings on a wall of our house in McLean, Virginia. Later, we'd watch adventure films, Four Feathers, the 1939 film about a young British officer who has to disprove his reputation as a coward during the invasion of North Africa. I think it is one of the great movies of all time, along with Call of the Wild and Captain's Courageous. I loved the latter movie so much, in fact, that when Vicky and I adopted a new puppy recently, we named him Captain's Courageous. I loved movies about the sea and about men at war. Later on, Dad would screen some romantic movies, but at the moment when the lead characters would start holding hands, he'd call out, "Teddy, it's time for you to go to bed." Jean wasn't much luckier. Just as they got to the embracing and kissing stage, she'd hear that voice of his, "Jean, you've got to go up to bed." The cranberry fields are smaller now than they were in 1941, as is every childhood image when seen through a grown-up's eyes. But my favorite boyhood vista from our porch in Hyannisport has not diminished. This is the shoreline, where the shallow waters of Nantucket Sound lap peacefully, then draw back toward the open sea. Tied up on the beach, in my memory, its flat stern bobbing in the surf, is a little boat. When I was 6, Joe and Jack began teaching me to sail in that little boat. They introduced me to the wind and the tides and the currents, and my life on the sea was underway. The boats grew larger over my lifetime, and I ventured farther and farther from shore. I sailed alone. I sailed with my own family. I sailed in regattas. I sailed with political leaders and celebrities who were my guests. I've sailed with just about anyone I could get onto the boat with me. I took up painting, first with acrylics and later with oils, to pass time with Jack when he was recuperating from back surgery in the 1950s, and then again when I was recuperating from an injury in the 1960s. And most of my canvases have been of sailing boats, including my cherished antique wooden schooner Maya, and of the sea, and of harbors. Safe harbors. Chapter 2. No Crying in This House, 1932 to 1938. Hyannisport is my true home, but it was not my first home. At the time of my birth on February 22, 1932, the family spent summers and early autumns in Hyannisport and then headed to Bronxville, New York for winters. The colonnaded house there stood in the village's leafy Sagamore Park neighborhood. Its 3 stories and 20 rooms occupied a crest of land, its red-tiled roof catching the sun above a thick scattering of tall old trees. We lived there in winter for 6 years after I was born. Dad had accumulated most of his fortune by then. He had traded brilliantly in the stock market and invested with his typical acuity in the still-young Hollywood movie industry. In 1928, my father had greatly increased his wealth by buying and consolidating 2 small movie-related businesses into Radio Keith Orpheum, RKO. He'd protected that fortune by phasing out of the market several months before the crash in October of 1929. The New York suburbs were new territory for the Kennedys. It is Boston, of course, that holds the deep, transplanted roots of my family in the New World, on both sides. The Irish famine drove my great-grandfather Patrick across the ocean to the city in the 1840s, and within a decade, Thomas Fitzgerald and several members of his large family made a similar pilgrimage. My parents' marriage in October 1914 united the Boston Kennedys and the Boston Fitzgeralds, and the couple settled in a trim little house on Beale Street in Brookline. The house still stands. It was where Jack, Kathleen, and Rosemary were born, assisted by Dr. Frederick Good, who presided at the births of all of us. Joe Jr., the first, arrived in a summer house in Hull, Massachusetts, in 1915. Dad moved the family to a larger house in Brookline where Eunice, Pat, and Bobby were delivered. The expanding family made an even larger house necessary, and Dad's expanding wealth made it possible. After the move to Bronxville, though, my mother insisted that one bond with her origins remain unbroken. Any children still to come would be born in her native city, never mind the intervening 200 miles. In 1927, she returned to her beloved Boston for the birth of Jean, and in early 1932, at the age of 41, my mother returned to Boston again for my birth at St. Margaret's Hospital. My mother saved many mementos of my birth, as she did for all the children. One of them I still have hanging in my Senate office, a framed card that bears an illustration of the White House. The card apparently accompanied a floral bouquet. Across its surface, in faded ink, is the handwriting of my mother, Perishable Flowers. The card is signed by President Herbert Hoover. There is a stamp mark of postage due, a rather humorous souvenir from the man who presided over the Great Depression. I was born Edward Moore Kennedy, after my father's longtime personal secretary, confidant, and close family friend. Eddie Moore had been an assistant to 3 Boston mayors, including John F. Honey Fitz Fitzgerald, my mother's legendary father. My dad cherished Eddie's convivial soul and his immersion in the Boston Irish political culture. This was the same Eddie Moore who rescued Jack, the chocolate frosting thief, from our brother Joe down at the Cape. When I was confirmed at 12 years old, a saint found his way into my name. We confirmation boys were told that we could keep our own middle names or add a saint's name to the one we already had. The boys ahead of me in the line all had middle names like Michael or John or James. When it came my turn, the bishop asked me mine, and I said, "Moore." He said, "No, your middle name." I said, "It's Moore." The bishop said, "Oh, Thomas Moore." I didn't want to hold up the line and call any further attention to myself, so I said, "Yes." In that way, my name became Edward Thomas Moore Kennedy. Given that St. Thomas Moore is the patron saint of politicians, I'm rather happy to have him in there. Even as a small boy, I missed the ocean during the months away from Hyannisport. But the Bronxville house, built around 1920 and sadly torn down in the 1950s, held many pleasures of its own. A curving third-floor balcony rested on top of three Ionic columns, and a smaller balcony below it stretched above the front entrance. Inside, amid the master rooms, were such modern wonders as shower baths, an oil-burning hot water heater, and a number of enclosed porches. The basement held a billiard table, and the garage was big enough for five cars. The part of the house that most interested me, though, was a large, dimly lit room up on the third floor. Inside it, my brothers presided over an elaborate, always-growing electric train system. Joe Jr. and Jack had begun the collection with Lionel cars and tracks supplied by Dad. Control shifted to Jack and Bobby as time went on, and the routes grew more intricate. When Jack began his travels, Bobby became chief engineer. My brothers could make you believe that running those trains was a mission of vital importance. But then they could give you that feeling with anything they were up to. They certainly convinced me. As soon as I was old enough to climb the stairs to the train room, I sat for hours watching the action with envy and fascination. I itched to get my own hands on the levers that made those engines race, and the signals flash, and the whistles shriek. But the train room was my brother's kingdom, and they were always happy to remind me who was in charge. Their message stuck. Just a few years ago, well over half a century on, I was visiting the Wyeth family at their home in Brandywine. Jamie Wyeth showed us into the room where his family kept its own model train system. Without warning, I was catapulted back across the decades to that third-floor room in Bronxville, and in my memory, I could hear Bobby's excited chatter above the sound of his engine and its cars on the track. And we were all startled by a loud voice that shook the Wyeth's room. "Don't touch the trains!" It was me, imitating Bobby. Bobby's voice, and those of the others in my family, echo through my early memories of Bronxville as they do through the house in Hyannisport. My father's voice is paramount. He was never abusive, never wounding toward any of his children, but he had a way of letting us know exactly what he expected of us. Once, when I was 13 or 14 years old, Dad called me into his room for a chat. I must have done something that prompted the conversation, but I don't remember what it was. But he used phrases so concise and vivid that I can remember them word for word nearly 65 years later. "You can have a serious life, or a non-serious life, Teddy. I'll still love you, whichever choice you make. But if you decide to have a non-serious life, I won't have much time for you. You make up your mind. There are too many children here who are doing things that are interesting for me to do much with you." I went back to my room with his words replaying in my mind. It didn't take me long to decide which kind of life I wanted to lead. Another powerful ethic that Dad taught us was to respect the privacy of others and to ignore whatever disrespect of privacy might come our way. I learned this particular lesson at a birthday party for myself in about 1946. My sister Kathleen had organized it and brought a lot of my friends to the house to play games. At some point in the afternoon, I wandered upstairs to use the bathroom, I think. I passed a bedroom and heard a boy's voice. I looked in and saw LaFay Page, one of the young party guests, talking on the phone, to one of his parents, I guess. His back was partly turned, and he couldn't see me. LaFay was saying, "I hope this party gets over pretty quick because it's really dull, and we're not having much fun at all. It's really drab, so will you come and get me?" I stood there sort of paralyzed and embarrassed that the boy felt my party was dull. Then I heard footsteps behind me. My father had just walked out of the master bedroom and spotted me listening to the telephone conversation. He quietly told me to come back with him into his bedroom. I thought maybe he was going to console me, but he had another topic entirely on his mind. He said, "Teddy, let me give you some advice. Follow it, and you'll be much happier for the rest of your life. Never listen to a phone call that isn't meant for you. Never read a letter that isn't meant for you. Never pay attention to a comment that isn't meant for you. Never violate people's privacy. You will save yourself a great deal of anguish. You might not understand this now, but you will later on. Well, he was absolutely prophetic in what he said. It is advice that I followed again and again, and its use has extended well beyond phone conversations and letters. I've learned to turn my attention away from all sorts of things that can cause anguish. For instance, the books, the magazine pieces, the newspaper stories that carry malicious gossip or opinions about me or my family. I just stopped hearing it after a while, and I have been happier for it. I would recommend Dad's advice to anybody. No observation by Joseph Kennedy Sr. had as much lasting influence as a similar dictum. There'll be no crying in this house. The house he had in mind, I am certain, was the House of Kennedy. He repeated this admonition to all of us, and he pronounced it with the force of moral law, and all of us absorbed its import and molded our behavior to honor it. There will be no crying in this house. To understand the profound authority of this charge to us is to understand much about my family. We have wept only rarely in public. We have accepted the scrutiny and the criticism as the legitimate consequences of prominence in a highly self-aware society. With exceedingly few exceptions, we have refused to complain against the speculation, gossip, and slander. Some have viewed our refusal as excessive reticence, even as tacit admission of the innuendo at hand. In my view, it is neither. At least for me, it's the continuing assent to Joseph Kennedy's dictum, "There will be no crying in this house." I associate Bronxville with late autumn and winter, and largeness. Everything within our gates seemed so large back then, including my siblings, from my littlest kid perspective. The three-story white house and its surrounding trees appeared to reach into the clouds. My sisters have told me they had the same sensation. A driveway bordered by shrubbery arced downward along the terraced lawn until it reached the street. Jack taught me to ride a bicycle through the swirls of autumn leaves on that driveway, and it was fun, except for the sudden stops. Jack and Bobby would helpfully push me along as the bike gained momentum and barreled down the drive until it was brought to a halt, say, by a tree, and I went tumbling over the bars into a heap. "That's very natural," Jack would assure me, as the two of them raced down the hill to pick me up. I was never quite convinced. Neighborhood children liked to romp into our yard for games of football and tag and sledding in the winter. Sometimes an emissary from the larger world, Hollywood, the Catholic Church, showed up at our house. President Roosevelt arranged for Dad to escort Eugenio Cardinal Pacelli to several sites around the country when Pacelli visited the United States in 1936, not long before he headed back to Rome and his eventual coronation as Pope Pius XII. One of his last stops was at our house. I remember crawling up onto his lap. I was fascinated by his long robe and scarlet skullcap and his long aristocratic nose. We still have the couch where he sat and the plaque that Mother put on it. The dinner table conversations at Bronxville were as lively as at the Cape, but it was here that Jack found a way to invest mealtimes with even more challenge and intrigue. He invented a new game. The pawn was the platter of roast beef. Jack's goal was to get served from it before the rest of us children. He knew that the platter always went to Dad first, and then to Mother. But which way would it travel after that? To the left or to the right? The question was important because whoever got served first was treated to a thick, juicy slab of beef, and the last person served had to settle for end scraps. Jack's guess on any given night determined which side of the table he'd choose to seat himself. He liked to say in later years that the reason he was so thin was that he always chose wrong. Every space around the big house was a potential source for adventure. Our roof looked to Joe and Jack as if it might be ideal for launching a parachutist. So they made up a parachute from sheets and ropes. For the test run, they were generous enough to invite the son of the chauffeur to share the adventure. They helped him on with the straps, and then they helped him off the roof. Luckily, he only suffered an ankle sprain, but it was a pretty bad one. Yet quiet moments there were, and even those were rich in stimulation. I can still see Bobby frowning into a magnifying glass as he bent his small frame over his stamp collection, which included contributions from President Roosevelt. Sometimes we brothers would sprawl on the floor and absorb practice maneuvers with the cast-iron soldiers that our father collected for us as Christmas presents from countries all over the world, their brilliant hand-painted uniforms rendered in precise detail. As we lined them up in battle formation, our mother would often bustle in, bearing maps and information about their countries of origin. Mother would make learning opportunities, too, from the dolls Dad bought in the countries he visited. These were spectacular dolls, always dressed in ceremonial costumes, accurate in detail. They were heavy, and sometimes a foot or so high. Mother would sit with the girls and the dolls and get them to think about the cultures they came from. How are the Polish dolls dressed, and why? What about the Lithuanians? What can their dress tell you about the people? Mother delighted in her acquaintances with Catholic bishops and cardinals, and later, popes. But she enjoyed social circles less ecclesiastical as well. During the 1930s, she was named the best-dressed woman in public life by a poll of fashion designers, and she became a familiar figure in international ports of call. After 17 years of birthing and nurturing her 9 children, Rose Kennedy, in her 40s, resumed her girlhood penchant for travel, making several trips to Europe and to her beloved Paris in particular. Dad would arrange to be at home with us when Mother was rekindling her love of European art, languages, and cities. Our parents escorted us on frequent excursions beyond the house and grounds. A Sunday ritual after church was our 2-car caravan into Manhattan for a family luncheon at a Longchamp's, that bygone chain of Art Deco restaurants with their stained glass and murals and heaping plates of delicious food. Then we'd all head over to Radio City for a movie. Jack must have loved those outings. He often brought Jackie to Longchamp's for dinner in the early days of their marriage. A reminder that the outside world was a lot less secure than our own occurred when I was 5, shortly after I was enrolled at a kindergarten off Pondfield Road in the Bronx. The school was only a 5-minute car ride from our house, and one fine autumn afternoon, I decided to impress my parents with my independence by walking home through the crunchy fallen leaves. My mother wasn't expecting this, and when she drove to the school and didn't find me, she grew terrified. The famous Lindbergh baby kidnapping and killing had occurred shortly after my birth, and parents across the nation were still haunted by it. My parents knew the Lindberghs and had observed their pain firsthand. And so, instead of congratulating me on my adventure when I strutted through the door, my mother reasoned with me via a coat hanger and then banished me to the closet. But the outside world also held wonder, especially when my father was along. He took me to a ball game at Yankee Stadium once when I was about 7. We had box seats, but Dad apparently found these a little too remote from the action and boosted me over the wall onto the playing field during batting practice. The ushers smiled at us and touched their caps. We strolled around, and I drank in all the huge, famous men in pinstripes firing baseballs at one another, and was just turning my attention back to the hot dog vendor roaming the seats when I heard Dad say, "Teddy, come over here." He was standing beside a big, grinning, moon-faced man in a business suit. "Teddy, this is Babe Ruth," Dad said, "the greatest baseball player of our time." Ruth had been retired for a couple years, but I knew who he was. Honey Fitz had told me about cheering the Babe when he played for the Red Sox before 1920, and my grandfather was an organizing member of the Royal Rooters. Now I'd have something to tell Grandpa. Ruth reached down a huge paw and grabbed my hand. I can't remember what I said to him, but to this day, meeting Babe Ruth remains the strongest memory I have of being awestruck by someone. I was tongue-tied. A household as teeming with children as ours required some reinforcements for the parents. I recall a couple of governesses in particular, one of them a legend within the extended Kennedy family, the other not quite so beloved. The less-than-adored caretaker was an Irish woman we called Kiko, who sometimes let our rambunctiousness get the better of her. I can still hear the nighttime thump, thump, thump of poor Bobby's forehead as Kiko banged it against a wall in an effort to discipline him. Bobby's famous hard-headedness served him well in these moments. Kiko did not last long at the Kennedy house. The legendary governess was Luella Hennessy, later Donovan, who was in our lives for 40 years, assisted at the births of 23 Kennedy children, lavished tender care upon my father after he suffered his stroke in 1961, helped nurse me back to health after my airplane crash in 1964, and was a particular favorite of Jack's. In 1963, President Kennedy coaxed the hard-working Luella to expand her horizons by enrolling at Boston College to get her college degree. He died before she received her Bachelor of Science diploma, but she endearingly remarked, "The president said he would come to my graduation if I got my degree. I guess he'll know I'm getting it." Our expanding household, as I noted earlier, was an important reason that Dad found it necessary to leave Boston. But there were other reasons, reasons I did not suspect as a child, reasons that had to do with the outside world from which he tried to shield us until we were ready for it. Much of what he knew about the world did not please Joe Kennedy, and some of it quite rightly infuriated him. The Boston of my dad's young manhood remained in certain ways as it had been since the mid-19th century. Two cities, in effect, mutually hostile and resentful. One was the silk-stocking Boston of old landed Yankee power and influence, Beacon Hill, Harvard, the bankers and captains of industry. The other consisted of the teeming storefronts and docksides. This was the Boston of immigrants' working-class descendants. These were mostly Irish, but included Italians and Portuguese. The Irish Catholics had established a small middle class, which overlapped with a strong and tightly knit political class. Mayor and Congressman Honey Fitz was an exemplar of the latter. My dad's own father, Patrick Joseph, lived in both. He was the soft-spoken owner of three saloons and a liquor importing business, a bank founder and president, a real estate promoter, and a leader of East Boston's Democratic Party, serving four terms as a state representative. He was a regular presence at community events, known for his gentlemanly manner and political influence. PJ and his perceptive wife, Mary, hoped their son would move upward in the world through the classic Irish route of politics. Dad had his own ideas. He thrived academically, at Boston Latin School and then Harvard. In 1914, he blocked the hostile takeover of his father's neighborhood bank and became, at age 25, the state's youngest bank president, ultimately becoming one of the financial masterminds of his generation. Dad immersed himself in the intricacies of buying and selling stock. In 1934, when the U.S. Congress created the Securities Exchange Commission to protect investors from insider trading, President Roosevelt appointed him chairman of the new regulatory agency. He was the right man for the job precisely because he knew how the system worked. Yet even as he marched through one invisible barricade after another, Dad always understood that he was never completely accepted as an equal by the old Yankee stock. He would always be an Irish Catholic first and an individual second. "I was born here. My parents were born here. What the hell do I have to do to be called an American?" he blurted after yet one more paper referred to him as an Irishman. In 1922, he was turned down for membership in a country club on Boston's South Shore, and years later complained that the Protestant elite would not have accepted his daughters as debutantes. He bought the home in Hyannisport only after realizing he could not gain entry into a more exclusive neighborhood. and even many families in Hyannisport greeted him coldly. His conviction that Boston was no place to bring up Irish Catholic children, as he declared to a reporter, was the impetus for the family's self-exile from the city. Dad could convey strength and inspiration precisely at those moments when he might seem, at a glance, to be stern and unbending. One example among many has lodged in my memory, perhaps because it involves an early encounter with the sea. We must jump ahead in time for a few moments, from Bronxville of the 1930s to Hyannisport in the summer of 1943, when I was 11. The war across the sea cast its long shadow, a half-terrifying, half-enthralling shadow for a boy, even into our little coastal village. Car owners were instructed to paint their headlights half black. All of the drapes in the Cape House were black, to keep any light from shore from reflecting off our tankers and troop ships that were moving up and down the coastline. And yet for a Hyannisport boy, these were almost make-believe precautions, hardly more urgent than storybook drama. The true object of my epic dreams was the timeless, shimmering water that lay before my eyes each summer day. For some months, I'd been allowed to explore Nantucket Sound in that 16-foot sloop, the One More. But I had another adventure in mind, and I was finally successful in getting Dad's permission. I wanted to take the boat around Point Gammon at the tip of Great Island, some 2 miles out on Nantucket Sound, and then to the mouth of the Bass River, 5 miles east. A short distance for an experienced sailor, an uncertain voyage for an 11-year-old boy. Adding to the adventure was the understanding that I would be out on the boat overnight. My crew on that voyage, as on so many voyages of my boyhood, was Joey Gargan, then an old salt of 13. It was a rainy day, but we boarded the little open boat anyway, clutching paper bags with our sandwiches inside. It rained and rained, but we pressed ahead through the choppy water. The big house disappeared into the fog behind us. Squinting against the wind and the salt spray, we made it around the point and onto the river mouth and anchored the boat near shore. Still it rained and it rained, and it was cold, and the day crept along, and it rained, and it was cold. We found ourselves trapped. Our overnight adventure no longer looked so enticing, but we had neither the strength nor expertise to get the boat back home. We spent a frigid night huddled inside that boat, hardly sleeping. A gray morning dawned. Wet and hungry, we left the boat at anchor and swam to the shore. Then we trudged until we found a gas station, from where we called up the house. Dave, our chauffeur, answered the phone. I groaned. "You've got to come down and get us. It's been bad. It rained all night. My sandwiches are wet, and I'm cold. Oh, I'm so cold." Dave came down and picked us up and drove us back to the house. Just as we arrived, we met my father getting ready to go out for his morning horseback ride. He said, "Teddy, I thought you were going for your little cruise." I said, "I did, Dad, but it was cold. It rained. It was bad. It was cold." "Where's the boat?" he asked. I said, "It's anchored at Bass River. We'll go back and get it later. But now I'm going upstairs to get warm and get breakfast and rest and get some sleep. I'm so cold and wet." But my father said, "Dave, take Teddy and Joey back to the boat. Teddy, if you leave with the boat, you come back with the boat." So the car turned around and off we went, me boo-hooing all the way. If there was anybody in the world who felt sorry for themselves that morning, it was me. But we arrived back at Bass River, and suddenly the sun came up, and a breeze came on up, and the sails on the boat came up, and the warmth came on out, and Joey and I had just a terrific sail that day. In the long hours and days and years, my father has been there to turn me around and send me back to do what is necessary, to come back with the boat. I can envision him now, striding toward me, looking me straight in the eye, his handshake firm, his laugh wholehearted. I grew up eager not to disappoint him, determined never to meet any challenge in a half-hearted way. Ultimately confident that if he knew I had done my best, he would, even if things turned out badly, give me what amounted to his benediction. After you have done your best, then the hell with it. My father knew whereof he spoke. By the dawn of the 1940s, he had already done his best on the world stage and failed. Failed to forestall the most devastating war in history. In February 1938, within days of my 6th birthday, Joseph Kennedy sailed for London to take up his duties as President Roosevelt's newly appointed ambassador to the court of St. James. History shows that Roosevelt, whose campaign Dad had vigorously supported, had conferred the appointment, despite my father's lack of diplomatic experience, in hopes that Dad could negotiate an important British-American trade agreement and that his famous bluntness would give the administration an unvarnished pipeline into Britain's responses towards Nazi Germany. On March 12th of that year, Adolf Hitler lit the fuse that would in time dash everyone's hopes for peace and detonate the Second Global War of the century, by sending his stormtroopers across the German border to occupy Austria, in direct violation of the Versailles Treaty. 3 days earlier, the happy insularity of my early childhood ended. Along with my mother, the other 4 younger siblings, Miss Dunn, and Luella Hennessy, I marched up the gangplank of the USS Washington to join Dad in London. Joe Jr. and Jack remained at Harvard. This would be my first time on the open sea. More important, the voyage would mark a transition in my understanding of the world. At a moment in history when the world was careening nearly beyond all understanding. Chapter 3. Wartime London, 1938 to 1939. My first ocean voyage opened up many facts about the sea that I'd never before suspected. One such fact was that it could make you seasick. Our 6-day crossing from New York Harbor to London took us through the North Atlantic at the height of the winter storm season, and my stomach felt every one of the 30-foot waves that daily lifted and rolled our ship. I love the water, but this was more water than I really wanted. The American ambassador's residence then was 14 Prince's Gate, on Kensington Road, across from Hyde Park. I later learned that this 4-story Victorian building had once been the London home of the banker J.P. Morgan. I was more interested at the time in the Indian chief in full headdress sculpted above the main entrance. Kathleen, Rosemary, Bobby, and I lived at number 14 with our parents, while Eunice, Pat, and Jean boarded at a nearby convent. Our bedrooms were on the 3rd floor. Bedroom hardly does them justice. Luella Hennessy later recalled mine as being almost as big as a schoolroom. She noted the twin beds, the big fireplace, a desk, a dresser, a chest of drawers, a chaise lounge, and a breakfast table with 2 chairs. A caged elevator got us to the main floor and back. I loved to race ahead of everyone else and push its activating button and hear the machinery start to clank. At age 6, I could tell that Dad was on an extremely important mission in London, but its nature was a mystery. Important visitors came to our residence, the King and Queen of Great Britain, for instance. It took more than a year, but George VI and Queen Elizabeth paid a call on Ambassador Kennedy in May 1939. We children were fixed up, cleaned up, and gussied up for this occasion. I seem to recall being told that they were the most important people in the world, and that this was the most important event that was ever going to happen. My involvement in it all was rather brief. I have blurry memories of the king in a scarlet tunic, his chest covered with braids and medals, and I remember that I practiced for hours to perfect my bow. Bobby and I later met Princess Elizabeth and Princess Margaret at Windsor Castle. We danced with each other. I doubt that any of us children made a huge impression on any other. The London press and public seemed taken with us. Everyone was curious about my dad, of course. What news and assurances this new ambassador might bring from America to a nation bracing for a massive Nazi assault, and how sympathetic this Irish Catholic would prove to British interests. I knew nothing of all this, just that a lot of adults with serious expressions wanted to talk to him. As for my sisters, Bobby and me, we submitted to scrubbing and hair combing, marched out to watch the changing of the guard, and smile. My mother certainly never forgot the spontaneous outpouring of human warmth, as she put it. She later wrote, "I almost began to feel that we had been adopted as a family by the whole British people." Life in London held its dangers. I found this out when a zebra decided to have me for lunch. He'd made a good start on my arm before a rescuer managed to get his mouth open. It happened during ceremonies reopening the Royal Children's Zoo in Regent's Park. The great British biologist, Julian Huxley himself, handed me the shears to cut the ribbon as the photographers pressed in. Bobby and Jean watched, representing little children everywhere, I suppose, and nice British ladies beamed. I cut the ribbon and handed the shears back, and then a zebra in a nearby cage caught my eye. I'd never before seen a real zebra. He looked friendly. I wandered over and reached through the bars to hand him a peanut. In the next instant, he had my arm in his mouth all the way up to my elbow. I screamed. The more I pulled away, the deeper the zebra's teeth took hold. Luckily, I had a thick coat on and a jacket underneath it, and a shirt underneath the jacket, so the animal wasn't able to bite deeply into my flesh. Still, he wouldn't let go. I screamed and pulled and hauled, and the zebra kept angling for a better fix. Some guards came running and tried to help, but they didn't quite have the drill down on how to extract an arm from a zebra's mouth. So someone summoned a very special zebra keeper. That's how I thought of him anyway. And he arrived and snapped a whip across the zebra's tailbone, and the animal sort of gagged and let me go. I wasn't seriously injured, but I did cause an incredible commotion that took a bit away from the occasion. There was Julian Huxley, and the nice ladies, and the pretty ribbon, and all the cookies and crackers, and all the little cups of juice that we were going to have, and suddenly there was this kid screaming at the top of his lungs that he was getting eaten by a zebra, and the kid happened to be the ambassador's son. I recall all the grown-ups in the vicinity calling out to me to keep a stiff upper lip. It wasn't my upper lip that I was concerned about. My sisters performed their ceremonial roles with a great deal more poise. Rosemary, then 19, and Kick, 18, made their social debuts just weeks after we arrived. The setting was Buckingham Palace, where they were to be presented to the Queen, and the event required endless drilling and preparation. My mother took them across the Channel to Paris on several weekends to select gowns for their debuts and the long string of social events that would follow. The evening arrived, and when their names were called, Kathleen and Rosemary made their march together in their shimmering white gowns from the antechamber up the red carpet toward the Queen. My sisters curtsied perfectly. Kick danced especially brilliantly through all of the debutante balls that season, the Kennedy Ball included, and her smiling beauty attracted partners from the British Isles, Europe, and Russia. For Bobby and me, the pageantry grew familiar in time, along with the peculiar diesel smell of London streets and the accents and the left-side driving. The demands of schoolwork took hold, and for me at least, a certain loneliness as well. The Gibbs School on Sloane Street near the square inaugurated my long and somewhat unhappy years of school life in Britain and then America. An endless succession of institutions, each of which had its own rules, cliques, standards, and punishment systems. I was to become something of an expert in punishment systems and obstacles to being liked. I liked to be liked, and up until my school years, I'd taken my likability for granted. After all, I was the youngest, used to being doted on by everyone. I am by nature and disposition a happy person. I like to laugh and have people laugh with me. If my siblings found themselves in trouble with Dad, they would sometimes send me into his room ahead of them to soften him up before the reckoning began. The world of strangers proved different. Bobby and I were driven to Gibbs in an embassy car at first, but before long we were confident enough to make our way by bus and underground. Bobby was 13 then, older than most of the Gibbs boys. He had little trouble with the curriculum. I was younger than most and had trouble with the curriculum and with everything else. I struggled to learn my lessons. I struggled to learn cricket. When I broke the rules, I was invited into the headmaster's office, where he made me hold my palms up and then whack them with a ruler until they were bright red. One rule that I'd learned from my parents was the need for politeness, especially given my high visibility as a diplomat's son. And so when a young British schoolmate named Cecil took to pounding on me every day, I handled the problem with perfect tact. I politely secured my father's permission before flattening Cecil. The loneliness I felt was obvious to those around me. Bobby tried to keep me company, but he joined a circle of friends his age. Dad spent as much time with me as he could, an amazing amount, given the obligations that preoccupied him. He came to my cricket games at school. He invited me with him on morning horseback rides along the centuries-old Rotten Row in Hyde Park, or at the lovely stables in Roehampton. In the evenings, before leaving the house with Mother for a dinner or the theater, he would come into my bedroom and read to me, sometimes for 45 minutes or an hour. I couldn't then fathom, of course, the burdens on his mind as he shared those moments with me. Only as a grown man myself, after the London days had passed into a bygone era, and I began to look through its history and our family's archives, did I begin to understand my father's anguished role in pre-war diplomacy, his passionate wish for American neutrality, his belief that neither America nor Britain was prepared militarily to engage Hitler's forces, the streams of letters he was writing back to President Roosevelt, senators, and journalists analyzing the international situation, and the speeches he delivered, blunt to the point of provoking outrage that led to the foreshortening of his diplomatic career. Nor could I have suspected that even as he poured out those unvarnished dispatches and speeches, Dad was dooming a possibility for himself that he must have known about and desired. The 1940 presidential campaign in America lay not far ahead. Franklin Roosevelt had already served 2 terms, and no president had ever served more. No one then knew for sure whether he would try to break the precedent, but as I learned much later, my father's name was among those being prominently circulated as his successor. I never asked my father about these things. I often wished I had. But they belonged, like other elements of his life, to a part of him that existed beyond our personal relationship. In my family, we did not press one another beyond these boundaries. Nor did we discuss with one another or the world the details of private behavior. It was a matter of respect. The Munich Conference of September 1938, which he did not attend, had given my father some hope that war might be averted. His friend and ally, the British Prime Minister, Neville Chamberlain, along with the French Prime Minister, yielded to Adolf Hitler's demand to occupy the Sudetenland, part of the famous appeasement strategy that in hindsight was catastrophic. German troops invaded Czechoslovakia the following March, and the frenzy of futile diplomacy intensified. As this latest barrier to peace was falling, our family journeyed from London to Rome to witness the coronation of Eugenio Cardinal Pacelli as Pope Pius XII. Dad was President Roosevelt's representative to the ceremony. We viewed the ceremony from the front row of a stand in a portico outside St. Peter's Basilica on Sunday, March 12, 1939. I later learned that the Kennedy entourage had created a minor diplomatic crisis for the Vatican. Official delegations were limited to 7 persons, and our group, including the governess, numbered 11. Joe Jr. was in Spain. But the problem was handled in the usual suave Roman manner. New seats were added, and everything was just fine. On the following day, Dad had an audience with the new Pope, and on Wednesday, March 15th, I received my first Holy Communion from the Pope himself at the Vatican. I wore a blue suit and had a white rosette on my left arm. As he blessed me, he said, "I hope you always be good and pious as you are today." It caused a great deal of a stir in some circles, a 7-year-old American boy given his first communion by the Pope, who himself was giving that honor for the first time as Pope, and to a non-Italian to boot. But it was among the greatest moments of my life. I received a beautiful rosary, blessed by the pontiff on that occasion, which I later gave to my stepdaughter Caroline Racklin on the day of her first Holy Communion some 60-odd years later. Our last family interlude of pre-war leisure was a month-long holiday in a villa Dad rented at Cannes on the French Riviera. Joe and Jack were on hand, and they gave me some sailing lessons and also taught me how to dive, using a cliff above the Mediterranean at the Eden Rock as the instruction site. That I had not yet learned how to swim well did not strike them as relevant to this exercise. One or the other would fish me out after I hit the water. All three of us kept this activity a secret from our father. Our interlude was cut short on August 24th. Germany and the Soviet Union informed the world that they had signed a mutual non-aggression agreement. The implications were massive. Poland, in particular, appeared to lie in the path of destruction. Dad left for London as soon as he heard the news. After meeting with a shattered Chamberlain, he contacted Mother and told her that she and we children must leave Europe. Our mother needed no convincing. The dread of a Luftwaffe assault over London had been running rampant since spring, when air raid drills grew common. Bobby and I witnessed the city's preparations for civil defense on our way to school and back. The sandbags, the barrage balloons, the scaffolding for gun emplacements. We'd participated in air raid drills, joining the flow of school children into bunkers, strapping on foul-smelling gas masks. We returned to classes clutching emergency rations. I have the strangest and most vivid memory of seeing human blood on the streets. Given that the bombing of London would not commence for a year, when I was safely out of the country, this memory is all but inexplicable. Unless it was blood from an accident or an incident that I had seen. Perhaps my memory is of a dream, fueled by the growing terror I saw and heard and felt every day. Whatever it was, the blood of Europe began to flow soon enough. On September 1st, Germany invaded Poland. 2 days later, Britain gave up the pretense and declared war on Germany along with France. My parents, Joe Jr., Jack, and Kathleen, sat in the Strangers' Gallery in the House of Commons that Sunday afternoon to listen to Neville Chamberlain issue the declaration that broke his heart, and to speeches in support of the declaration. Afterward, hysteria seized the city. Keepers killed all the poisonous snakes in the London Zoo, lest they be freed to slither about the city when their cages were shattered by Nazi bombs. That night, the city was blacked out, and air raid warnings sounded throughout London, but no attacks came.
On September 5th,
President Roosevelt issued a proclamation of American neutrality. Poland surrendered on September 27th. By the end of 1939, artillery duels were erupting along the Western Front. By this time, most of the Kennedys were back in the United States. Dad took precautions in booking several of us on two different ships, not wishing to lose all of us in a torpedo attack by one of the U-boats that now prowled the North Atlantic's depths. Joe sailed several days later on the Mauritania, surrounded by a convoy, and Jack flew westward aboard the new Pan-American airship, the Yankee Clipper. The two of them re-entered Harvard. Joe began making preparations for the Democratic Convention in Chicago the following summer. Dad and Rosemary remained in England. Rosemary was enrolled at a Montessori school in Hertfordshire, well away from the bombers' likely targets, a school where she was showing signs of learning improvement. My father continued his duties and began planning for a December visit to the States, where he would meet with Roosevelt and then celebrate Christmas with us in Palm Beach. Kathleen, who loved London and who would soon return, described our final night at number 14 in a brief essay, Lamps in a Blackout. She lamented the absence of the scintillating signs of Piccadilly and Leicester Square, the gaily lit nightclubs. But yet the moon shines through, and one can see new beauties in the silent, deserted city of London. She described vignettes of our family's fumbling attempts to cope with the blackout regulations. Young Ted ripped the black curtain to prevent the last ray of light from shining through. Within 5 minutes, 3 air raid wardens called to complain of great streaks of light shining through the window. Jean sprained her ankle in falling downstairs. Joe returned from an exploring trip with a very swollen eye. No one believed his story of walking into a lamppost until we read in the next morning's paper of hundreds bumping into trees, falling on the curb, and being hit by autos. Thus, now one hears the tap, 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 not of machine guns, but of umbrellas and canes, as Londoners feel their way homeward. She concluded, "May England soon have her midnights changed to midday with lights of victory, and until then, may the moon and stars and brilliant lamps of courage and faith shine gloriously in the blackout." I lacked my sister's eloquence and perception of what was happening, but I missed my father, worried about him, and wrote to him from Bronxville. "Dear Daddy, it snowed on Friday, and give my love to Rose. I hope not many bombs have dropped near you. Sir James come on Sunday. We have bought some pansies flowers, and I am taking care of them. My reading is better in school. Love, Teddy." Chapter 4, Boarding School Boy, 1940 to 1950. Back home in America at the end of 1939, I began my preparatory school years on a note of great expectation. Yet these did not prove to be happy, joyous years. I was very young, nearly always younger than my grade level, and nearly always a stranger. Counting kindergarten at Pondfield and Gibbs in London, I attended 10 schools between 1937 and 1950, 9 of them before high school. That kind of transience was not a recipe for academic success. In those years, as the family shuttled seasonally between Hyannisport and Palm Beach, I was essentially without a central home as well, although Cape Cod felt most like one. My father met with Roosevelt in Washington on December 8, 1939. We all celebrated a Christmas reunion at the Palm Beach house, and not long afterward my father sailed back to London. In January 1940, we all began to fan out. Pat, Eunice, and Jean returned to their pre-London schools. Kathleen, almost 21 now, completed her studies at Finch College in New York. Early in 1941, she took her writing talents to the Washington Times Herald, working as a research assistant before she was promoted to reviewing plays and movies. In the spring, Rosemary flew home from England in the care of Dad's close friends, Edward and Mary Moore. Joe Jr., who'd served as an informal secretary to Dad in London after graduating Harvard in 1938, enrolled in Harvard Law School. Jack graduated cum laude from Harvard in June, the season in which Why England Slept was published. He enrolled in the fall at the Stanford Graduate School of Business, and in the spring, he traveled through South America, meeting up with Mother and Eunice in Rio de Janeiro. Mother enrolled Bobby at Portsmouth Priory, a school run by Benedictine monks in Portsmouth, Rhode Island. I initially stayed with Mother, but when she moved from Palm Beach to Bronxville with the seasons, I did too. In the second grade alone, I attended 3 different schools, with 3 different curriculums, with 3 different peer groups, and sets of friends to make. By the spring of my third grade year, Mother thought that a short-term stint in boarding school was the best option for me, and she tried to ease the pain of separation by having me go to the same school as Bobby. If we both were at Portsmouth Priory, she reasoned, he could look after me, and I wouldn't be so lonely. And anyway, we would all be together on Cape Cod in the summer. The Benedictines were happy to accommodate Mother's wishes, but there was a bit of a complication. Portsmouth Priory started in the 7th grade. It had no elementary school. "No problem," said Mother. "Bobby, a 14-year-old 8th grader, would be there to look after me. And after all, she was planning to keep me at Priory just until the end of the school year." Unfortunately, just until the end of the school year, even if it's just 2 or 3 months, can be a very long time. I entered the seventh grade at Portsmouth Priory in the spring of 1941 when I was barely 9 years old, boarding and competing with boys who were 4 years older than me. It was a recipe for disaster. My time at Portsmouth Priory was not an education. It was a battle. I took French, which I'd studied a little at Gibbs. On my first exam, I got a 13. I went to math class, but the work was incomprehensible to me, and so was Latin. My classmates did not befriend me. Once in a while, if I was really lucky, someone would take me out for a sail on a boat, but I was rarely chosen to go. I was rarely picked to be on any of the teams during that period because I was so young. Bobby was there, of course, but being a regular teenage boy, he already had his own group of friends and was generally involved with them. A few of my classmates proved as cruel as only children can be. I brought my pet turtle to school with me, and in those hours of loneliness, I played with him. But after a few weeks, my turtle died. I took him outside and dug a hole in the frozen ground outside my dormitory, where I buried him and said a few prayers, giving him my own 9-year-old version of a funeral. Then I went back inside, found my cubicle — our dormitory rooms were cubicles with open ceilings — and crawled into bed and cried myself to sleep. At some point during the night, I was awakened by a strange sound from the hallway. Thump, 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 and then laughter. I didn't know what it was until the next morning, when I awoke to find my dead pet turtle in my bed. Some of the students must have spotted me burying him. That night, they dug him up and tossed the shell with his lifeless body back and forth down the hall. Thump, thump, thump. And then they put him between my sheets. I buried him again that morning. Bobby didn't think that family solidarity required him to be my protector. One day I got into a fight with a boy named Plowden. He was a head taller than me and soon had the better of me, twisting